Good morning and welcome to Locus Focus. I'm Barbara Bernstein, your host for Wednesday morning call and talk radio here on KBOO Community Radio, where the time is 4 minutes after 8 o'clock. And the number to call to join in the conversation this morning is 503-231-8187. This morning we're going to be talking about climate change and Portland's response to it in particular. Portland was one of the first American cities to take climate change seriously. In 2007, Portland was the only large metro area in the United States that actually reduced its carbon emissions below 1990 levels. But that doesn't mean we can just rest on our laurels. If this region is to succeed in radically reducing our carbon footprint, there's a lot more work to be done. So this morning, we're joined by Portland Mayor Sam Adams to talk about Portland's new climate action plan. And welcome to Locus Focus, Mayor Adams.
Good morning. Glad to be here, Barbara.
And so reading through the draft plan this week, I was reading a countercultural manifesto written in the 1970s, describing a world we were trying to create back then, where we all bike, walk, or take mass transit, get out of our cars and maybe just ban them from the city, grow our own food, or at least eat locally whole foods, protect forests and farmland inside and outside the city, recycle, and consume a whole lot less. So how did this once fringe viewpoint become the blueprint for the future of Portland?
Well, I think a couple of reasons. One, we need to do it. Our new goal of reducing carbon emissions by 80% by 2050 and 40% by 2030, I think the state of the planet calls for it. But I think in the intervening 25 years, we've also shown here in Portland that you can have a good quality of life while doing that and be economically successful as well. So it used to be that, you know, back in the 70s when the pioneers of these efforts, were sort of received as if they were asking everyone to start wearing, you know, a hair shirt, you know, and to give up and to change their lives, their quality of lives radically. And Portland, to a greater degree than most other cities, has shown that's not true. A good example is the green dividend we enjoy in transportation. Portlanders use their car about 20% less than most comparable cities our size. And for us, that, you know, all the benefits to the environment, the benefits to our health. But there's also, you know, that's about $1 billion that Portlanders don't spend on car-related, you know, activities, and that stays in our economy. You know, we don't make cars here. We don't have oil wells here, you know. So every dollar we save on the car stays in our economy and makes our economy about $1 billion that much more resilient.
Well, before we talk about some of the specifics of this climate action plan that's actually a draft, and I guess this is the way my copy says public comment draft, so we're going to be calling for public comments, and you can make your public comments on this draft.
Absolutely.
What you need to do is read it really quickly, and I don't have the website in front of me to go there.
Just go to mayorsamadams.com, and it's right on the front of my website.
Yeah, it's actually our portlandonline.com and then /sustainability.
BPS/climate is another way to get to it.
So, or you can just Google Climate Action Plan 2009 Portland, Oregon. So I expect people to be speed reading it in the next minute or so. And then we can talk about it and you can add your comments. And again, the number to call is 503-231-8187. We already have a call. Somebody has already read this plan. So good morning.
Morning. Thank you. I would like to say to the mayor, if we really want to get serious about meeting these goals as regards CO2 emission reductions, we can't build a 12-lane CRC bridge. We've got to go with Robert Liberty's plans, and I don't know why those aren't being taken up. What is your main objection, that it's a drawbridge? I've heard you say that, but it would seem to me that the river traffic could be directed in such a way that wouldn't be a problem in keeping the existing bridge.
Well, what I've offered for the crossing is entirely consistent with this emerging climate action plan. Right now, the way the project has been handled up to this point are requirements that we make all these small little decisions, and that adds up to the final decision. What I put forth, although not well sort of covered or understood, is what I put forth is, first, we have to establish the performance goals for the crossing. And only then will we make final decisions about what that crossing will be. The initial engineering will be done to accommodate up to 12 lanes, but that is not a final decision. In fact, just last week, as we're looking at value engineering, I was pleased to see that even the sponsors of this project were talking about, you know, the possibility of scaling back all kinds of aspects. But to keep the peace with our friends to the north, because I do want light rail over to Vancouver, what has been on the table for study and only study is the possibility for a structure to accommodate 12 lanes. In terms of staying with the existing crossing, there's a political problem. We won't get funding for a light rail line without addressing the drawbridges. And I have to say, from a substantive point of view, you know, these bridges are not going to fall into the river by any earthquake anytime soon, from what I can tell. But I'm not interested in having us so vulnerable to two old drawbridges. I don't think that they're going to fall into the river either. But the fact that they could break down or be, you know, someone could monkey with them, then we're stuck with just one way to cross the river in this region. So, and the other thing is the existing structure isn't working in terms of reining in sprawl. I mean, sprawl has happened with this existing structure. You know, I want tolls, I want light rail, I want a comprehensive approach to the new crossing that has to make a big contribution to these climate action goals. I live in North Portland, and I can tell you the pollution emitted by the status quo is unacceptable.
Actually, before we get, I mean, I don't want to get into some real specific, and particularly spend a lot of time talking about the Columbia River crossing today, because we've talked about it in the past, and I'm sure we're going to talk about it in the future.
We will.
So we can maybe get to these things towards the end of the show, but I want to, like, get to it and talk a little bit more in generalities first about what this plan is about. And is the caller still on?
Yeah, I'm still on. So my understanding is that the main reason we can't keep the existing bridge is because we won't get any light rail funding unless we replace the bridge. Is that what you're saying, Mayor?
No, I'm saying, well, that's the political reality. The substantive reality is I'm not interested in keeping the status quo, and it is not in the best interest of our safety and our economy to assume the next 50 to, you know, 90 years with drawbridges.
Okay, I think we're going to, let's leave this for another subject, another program. Okay, we're losing that caller. And I think for other callers, I'd like to talk a little bit more generally about this plan, and then we can get into some of the specifics. And I know some of them are going to be controversial, I'm sure. But I think
lots of controversy.
Yeah, I think the Columbia River Crossing, which is, I think, a big discussion in itself, I'd like to save for another program. So we're going to, as much as that has everything to do.
I'll come back, I promise.
Okay, right, good. With Robert Liberty.
Absolutely.
We had Robert Liberty on a couple months ago. So that's a pledge we got from the mayor that we will deal with this in the future. But I think we'd like to look at the big picture. And I actually wanted to start out with the big picture. I have these memories. I'm trying to think about, like, well, what is creating the climate to create this climate action plan here in Portland? Why is Portland ahead of the curve in so many areas, even though we are probably behind the curve in terms of really seriously addressing the problem of climate change? And so one of my memories is this big parking lot on Southeast Hawthorne and around 23rd back in the early 70s, which was the Portland recycling team's first recycling center in Portland, where we would go and do all the recycling. And I remember I just moved to Portland, and recycling was a very novel concept to me. I mean, I had no idea what it was, except that I remembered when I was a kid, my mother said that she would file her garbage because I think, I don't know what it was. Our garbage slops, the food garbage would go to the farmer, and then the bottles went one place, and the other stuff I think was garbage.
It was a lot of effort.
It was. And so then I moved to New York, where you didn't have to file your garbage, and it was great. You just throw it all in one place. And then I came out to Portland, and people were recycling, which is a different kind of concept.
Mm-hmm.
But suddenly it made a lot of sense. And in those days, you could basically recycle metal and you could recycle glass. It was long before the days of plastic and paper.
And you had to take the labels off and you had to smash the cans.
Exactly.
And my mom used to do that growing up in Newport. And then we had to drive like 13 miles to Toledo, Oregon to recycle.
Right. It was a big effort. And I remember at one point where I was recycling with a friend and he said out of the blue, I wonder if Bob Dylan recycles. Bob Dylan being his role model all the time. And it was an interesting question. I've never gotten an answer to that. But I think it showed that really back in 1972, 73, recycling was not very mainstream. And yet in a certain part of Portland, and obviously your family out in Newport, it was pretty much the way to go. And I'm wondering if that has, because Portland was recycling, at least in spots of Portland and spots of Oregon were recycling as early as the early 70s, if that has created a sort of a climate here that is helping us to take more seriously some of the environmental issues that we're facing now.
I think that's right. And I also think that, you know, when you read the history of Portland and in Oregon, there have been sort of these, you know, some very bad behavior vis-a-vis the environment, but, you know, especially looking back. But at the time, there were also a number of very enlightened folks that, you know, established public beaches and, you know, established Forest Park here in Portland. And at the time, you know, didn't have to, didn't get big rewards for it necessarily. But, you know, we have had this history and this legacy of concern for the environment, consciousness about the environment to a greater degree than other contemporary locales at various times. So we inherit that legacy. But the other part of your point that I remind people and that I worry most about is that we will rest on our laurels, that we will, as good as we are, we'll think, you know, great. You know, we have the highest residential recycling in the nation. Check. You know, we're the only city in the United States that has reduced our greenhouse gas emissions. Check. You know, and what I remind people, as great as that is and as inspiring as that should be for us, it's also, you know, we're getting good grades on a very low standard. You know, that this nation, you know, most cities in this nation have just terrible records on these issues. So it should inspire us. It should not leave us with this false sense that we've arrived and no more work is necessary.
Now, we got a few callers on the line, but before we take our callers, I just wanted to kind of go over some of the general areas that this climate plan addresses. What's the structure of it, and what is it trying to, what kinds of questions and answers is it trying to raise?
Well, we've divided the climate action plan up into 8 areas, some substantive, some are process oriented, everything from how we're going to reduce our greenhouse gas emissions, you know, related to transportation, related to dwellings, residents, how we're going to adapt to, because even under the best case scenario, we're going to have to adapt to changes before any of the benefits kick in. There's a chapter on that. So buildings and energy, land use and mobility, consumption and solid waste, urban forestry, food and agriculture, community engagement, climate change preparation, and then local government operations. And when you look at the plan, this is the draft, and the reason I'm here and we're doing 5 town halls around the city is we're looking for comments. We're looking for, you know, the good Portland tough question, how we can improve this, even a substance in here that might be exactly right on, but it's indecipherable or could be clearer. The part of this plan that is very much underway is, and we'll talk a lot about at the town halls, the first one of which is Monday at 5:30, for businesses, focused on businesses at 322 Northwest 6th Avenue, Suite 200. And that is, in addition to this sort of plan and strategy, we want people to walk out of these meetings with a sense of what they can do to improve on their impacts within the, you know, $20 in 20 minutes, and then sort of a hierarchy from there.
So overall, like, it's divided into 8 sections, the plan, the objectives, and the actions. And so I want to just kind of go quickly over what these sections are. And for instance, with buildings and energy, which is the first section, how would our buildings and energy look different in 2050 than they are right now?
Well, here in Portland, we have the advantage of having more LEED certified buildings.
And what does LEED mean?
It's basically buildings that are certified by an international standard, and the highest you can get is, you know, LEED gold. And we have more of those types of buildings, so we have more hands-on experience in the area of buildings. But our goal is to, you know, reduce the total energy use of all buildings built before 2010 by 25%. And we've got the Clean Energy Fund, which I talked about in my State of the City speech, which would be the nation's first on-bill payback clean energy audit and retrofit. We're starting with the pilot in residential homes and hopefully expanding it to commercial and industrial. The big weakness, the big vulnerability in all this environmental sustainability stuff in the urban environment has been actually financing. We all know a lot of what needs to get done, But this whole effort has survived on a lot of government handouts, tax credits, and feebates, and people's own personal efforts. What we're doing with the Clean Energy Fund for the first time, if we can pull it off, is we've got a partnership with PGE, Pacific Core, Northwest Natural, and Shore Bank, and it'll be the first time where you'll do the audit, and then you'll be able to, an Energy Trust of Oregon, and you'll be able to pay off the upfront costs for changing out your, you know, your heating and cooling system, weatherization. You'll be able to pay that off over the 15 to 20 years useful life of those benefits. And that's been the big stumbling block. In order for us to get the kind of benefits out of the building and facility aspects of our plan, we need to have something like that. And we're getting a lot of national attention. We get visitors from around the country because if we pull this off, it'll be the first time anywhere in the United States.
Well, I'm just thinking that I've been interested myself in getting an energy assessment for my house. And then I think I really don't need it because I've had so many people coming in telling me what's wrong with the house. The house is 102 years old. And we've been changing out windows and putting thermal windows in and insulation, of course. We do it piecemeal as we can, but it's kind of a nightmare insulating a three-story 100-year-old house.
Well, this will
help me be able to finish the weatherization of my house.
It will, and what it means is, and eventually add the possibility also on-bill financing for, you know, eco roofs and for solar, maybe micro wind, hopefully someday. But that idea is most people, you know, most of Portland's housing stock, like most cities, is built, and so we've got to have a retrofit program. And with over 100 houses, residential houses in this city, we got a big to-do list here. And so the Clean Energy Fund, if we can help you do your entire house, have the economies of scale of doing your entire house at one time, you actually lower your energy costs, but some of that you're not going to actually pocket because it's going to pay off over the next 25 years, the upfront costs. It's a win-win, a total win-win.
So how much would people be paying upfront costs then to, let's say, replace all the old leaky windows in their house?
Well, again, the idea here is that there be virtually no upfront cost out of pocket to you because you're going to pay it off in small amounts on a quarterly or monthly basis, depending on your bill, over the next 20 years. And if you sell your house, then the payoff goes on the bill with the house. But the trade-off here is you likely will pay less after you do your energy retrofit, because you'll be saving money that is now being wasted with an inefficient home.
Yeah, well, actually, we can attest to that because we've done about half of it, and our energy bills have gone down considerably. So I can imagine how much more they go down if we finished off the rest of the leaky windows.
And if we can perfect this model here in Portland, I can tell you, based on the kinds of visits and inquiries we've been getting, it's a model that's going to take fire across the United States.
Now, I'd like to take some of the callers we have waiting, but just to kind of run over that the areas where the plan is addressing have to do with, besides building and energy efficiency of buildings, has to do with land use and transportation, consumption, and solid waste. And this is where the hippie ethic really comes in strongly, when we're told we have to stop buying lots of stuff and lots of packaging and just, you know, use basic things and recycle and reuse and buy things that last a long time. And you know, you gotta think about that iPod. Anyway, and then the issue of urban forestry, food and agriculture, community engagement, which has always been a very important part of being a resident of Portland, is being civically engaged. And then there's preparation for climate change, which has to do also with, I guess, the adaptation issues.
Right.
And then finally, how local governments are operating. So those are the areas, and we'll be talking a bit more about that in detail. You can join the conversation by calling 503-231-8187. I'm here this morning with Portland Mayor Sam Adams, and we're talking about the Climate Action Plan 2009, which is in its public comment drafts form right now. Again, the number to call is 503-231-8187. It's about 22 minutes, almost 23 minutes after 8 o'clock. We have Mike on the line. Good morning. You're on the air.
Yeah, this is Mike Houck with the Urban Green Spaces Institute. Hi, Sam.
Hi, Mike.
Barbara. I've read the plan. Actually, before I say anything, I'd really like to congratulate Sam on taking leadership role in this issue and over the past few years, his Greater Green Initiative, which is really taking a closer look at how we build the city and integrating nature more with the built environment. And that brings me to, both of you mentioned the word adaptation, and I think the plan's fabulous on the mitigation side in terms of reducing greenhouse gases. There is some mention of the concept of adaptation, which Sam alluded to. We know that for example, we're going to be experiencing much more severe rain events during the winter. The pattern of precipitation is going to change pretty dramatically, according to the folks who've looked at potential impact. So my concern is that the plan does not really integrate the concept of adaptation as much as I think it ought to. And I'll be sending my comments in, but I just wanted to give Sam an opportunity to perhaps elucidate on the whole concept of adaptation and what part of the plan really addresses those issues. For example, we know that floodplains are probably likely to expand significantly over what FEMA currently tells us the 100-year floodplain is. There are issues like that.
I think that's really good constructive criticism. I think it's on point, and the the implications also include the food water sources, food supplies, power supplies, health and safety. And I think that the plan relative weakness in this area is also where I asked when I was sworn in as mayor for the Office of Emergency Management to do a comprehensive assessment of potential on the ground, in the sky, in the rivers impacts for what we know will likely be the climate change impacts locally. And that work will be done by the end of summer. So I think that this area of the plan does need to be strengthened. I think Mike's right. And I think that with the work that the Portland Office of Emergency Management is doing and their assessment, that we'll be able to sort of integrate their work in the fall into this draft plan.
Yeah, I'm hopeful that we can talk more about, in addition to that, connecting the dots between what Portland Park is doing with their acquisition program and some of the things you talked about with David Bragdon in terms of how to marry the work Bureau of Environmental Services is doing, for example, in Johnson Creek by acquiring additional green spaces that will serve as that green infrastructure that will sequester CO2, but also be what I call a buffer to future floodplain changes and landslide hazards for that matter.
Good feedback. I appreciate it.
Well, thanks a lot for calling, Mike. And I guess we're going to be doing a show with you in the near future looking at the green infrastructure, as you call it, as capital assets for the city.
That would be fabulous. It'd be great to have Sam on that program as well.
Okay, we'll see if we can arrange that as well.
Thanks a lot
for calling. Yeah. And I'm talking this morning with Mayor Sam Adams, and we're discussing the Portland Climate Action Plan that is in draft form and looking at how Portland can better face the realities of climate change that are coming down upon us pretty fast, and how we can, or ways that we really need to really rethink and retool our environment and our own lives and lifestyles to really address these changes. And you can join the conversation by calling 503-231-8187. We've got Scott on the line. Good morning. You're on the air.
Good morning, Barbara. I have two questions for Mayor Adams. Mayor, you said you grew up in Newport, which is the location of the Central Lincoln People's Utility District, a nonprofit citizen-owned electric utility. Why is it that the draft plan doesn't mention a critical structure, which is the actual platform that all these ideas are applied to? How do you feel about the idea of a publicly owned nonprofit electric utility, such as a city-owned municipal utility, or the other alternative, a People's Utility District with a separate elected board separate from the city council?
Well, I've prioritized, my efforts and what's prioritized in the plan, the efforts that are going to get the greatest benefit in the shortest amount of time. Our efforts are focused on, as is in the plan, of reducing the impacts in the areas of the city, or the aspects of the city that are producing more of the greenhouse gas, and our efforts at district heating and cooling, our efforts contained in the plan are what I'm focused on. I was part of the council that supported making a run at creating public power, and you're right, I grew up in a public power community. Right now, this is what I think is most important to focus on. We took a run at it. We failed. And, I'm not going to take a run at it before I, again, until I feel like we're really on track with this plan.
Now, there's a couple things that are mentioned in the plan that I think they're not quite as all-consuming as having actually a public utility district that Scott's talking about. But there's the concept of district energy, which was a new one to me. And then the other one, which I have been learning a little bit about and I was real excited, was basically having small locally generated alternative energy, like whether small windmills or solar setups, that would basically just generate power for a building or maybe for a neighborhood?
Yeah, eco-districts and district energy heating and cooling. You know, I want to wean Portland's 42% that currently comes from coal, Boardman, and the Rocky Mountains. I want to wean us off that. So I'm really focused on the ground initiatives that will achieve the results. Again, having gone through 3.5 years of the fight of public power here in Portland, worthy effort, but right now I'm focused on trying to get the results we need.
Now, what
thank you, Mr. Mayor. I just had just one comment, which is this is really critical. District energy, which I'm familiar with in Southeast Portland, that proposal. They're all based on a platform of for-profit. Now, you yourself mentioned Northwest Natural Gas, PGE, and Pacific Power, and Shorebank, all for-profit corporations.
Yes.
They get their cut. So all these ideas may in and of themselves be great ideas, but it's on a platform of for-profit. And if we're talking, let's say, they make 10% profit, just as a sake of argument, that's 10% that's wasted that could be going into having solar panels on homes or having reduced electric rates so people can afford their utility bills. So I would just like to say that this plan should have as an alternative, regardless of your previous history on the council, that it should be outlined that it is the citizens' right to have publicly owned utilities that serve electricity at a nonprofit. And then all those ideas can be placed on that nonprofit platform.
Your point is a fair point. This is the direction that I think we need to go in for now.
Okay, thanks a lot for calling. I actually wanted to ask a little bit more about what district energy is, because that was a relatively new concept for me. Our caller, Scott, might be familiar with it, but maybe a lot of other people aren't.
Well, you know, it's really about, in terms of new neighborhoods, it's about central heating and cooling for the entire neighborhood, where there are huge economies of scale. As opposed to having, you know, 50 power plants, you know, you have one or two. Actually, it's kind of going back to the future in the sense that, you know, downtown Portland used to, the buildings that you, many of which you see right now and still stand, were serviced by steam heating, district heating, of which they tell me the energy was sort of an offset or a offshoot of the industrial mills, lumber mills. Well, it's kind of going back to that. There are huge benefits in terms of greenhouse gas reduction, meeting greenhouse gas reduction goals by having, you know, six blocks serviced by one heating and cooling system as opposed to, you know, in those six blocks having, you know, 50 different furnaces.
So this is like the old, like the steam heat that have in old New York apartment buildings, only hopefully it won't clang like those do.
Well, you know, we'll do our best. Can't guarantee anything about
but
the clang.
But it's the same idea, basically, that the heat, is, and I guess the cooling, I'm not sure how that would work with steam, but the heating is done by just piping steam underground, and then it would go into all these different buildings?
As well as the opportunities of geothermal benefit. I mean, a lot of folks think that geothermal is about, you know, drilling to the core mantle of the earth to, you know, and it isn't. When I was in China, they have, you know, new neighborhoods where the geothermal benefits are pipes that are literally buried 3 feet under the ground. So it's sort of using the landscape of a set of a geographic area to the most efficient benefit for the heating and cooling needs of that district with one or few power plants.
And the thing that excited me, which I think Scott might be happier about too, was the whole concept too of generating, having small generating facilities. I mean, this is one thing that I've been arguing for a number of years with, like, wind power. It seems like, why are we concentrating so much in building these gargantuan windmill farms in central and eastern Washington and Oregon that, you know, and now a golden eagle has been killed. You know, it raises a lot of concerns for people when wind power is so beautifully designed to be a local source. I mean, you can have your neighborhood wind generator, and basically that could serve a whole community. So is this actually now part of the plan?
Absolutely. And so if you combine sort of the geothermal solar, wind, eco-roofs, trees, the greater green concepts, and you do that in a single larger geographic unit than a house or office building or an industrial endeavor, you can get incredible efficiencies on the energy side and huge reductions in greenhouse gas emissions. Again, the big weakness in all of this has been financing. How do you monetize 25 years of energy not spent up front? And that's why the Clean Energy Fund that we were about to launch, the pilot of that, is so important. We've known for quite a while what to do. It's been, how do you afford to do it? And that's why, you know, this plan, it's also important as you look at the finance, to break through the financing barrier with this plan, is that you've set some aggressive goals. And I believe you get what you plan for.
Now, as far as the partnership for this fund, so you said that it's Portland General Electric,
Pacific Core,
Northwest Natural Gas, and then Shorebank, and it was the last
City of Portland, and Oregon Energy Trust. Energy Trust of Oregon.
So Energy Trust.
Who've been fantastic, by the way.
Right, and that's a nonprofit, isn't it?
Correct, and they get their resources off the bills themselves.
Right, and then Shorebank is a funny hybrid. I mean, I guess it's a for-profit, but it's really for the public good. Then we have these other three entities, the utilities, which a lot of environmental people like Scott Forrester see as the evil empire.
Sure.
And I'm wondering, how do we kind of bring the evil empire on board in ways that is both in their interests, which have often been at odds with the interests of a larger community, both in terms of conservation, in terms of clean energy production, and in terms of like really serving the public good?
Well, you get them comfortable with a financial model that they at least don't lose money on and make a profit on, ideally, in the sense that so many of the utilities across this nation are for-profit. There's plenty of nonprofit, but there's plenty of for-profit as well. Nonprofits, you know, they have a board of directors, often elected. They can sort of move in directions that, you know, they can move based on the vote of the board. For-profit, you know, if we can get the for-profits to sign up on this new sort of financing model, you know, there's no excuse for the nonprofits. And yet, this is the only on-bill program out there that is about to actually launch.
The only on-bill? Which means what?
Meaning that it's the only on-bill financing, that you're financed and you pay it off on your electric bill. There are other places, and there's bills in the state legislature that would also provide bonding capacity based on property valuations or property taxes. That's going to be a very useful tool as well. But the big breakthrough here that people have been talking about for 10 years is the financing and the on-bill payoff that stays with the property.
Well, we've got some more callers. We're talking with Mayor Sam Adams today about Portland's Climate Action Plan, which is a serious, very serious look at how the changes being brought on by climate change that we need to face and how we're going to drastically reduce our carbon emissions. And I guess another thing before we take some more callers, there's these baseline years that we're throwing out. I'm not sure everybody understands. Like, why 1990? Why 2030? Why 2040? Mm-hmm. Why 2050?
Well, our goal of reducing local carbon emissions by 80% by 2050, you know, I get some pushback on, but, you know, I just spent some quality time with the mayor of Vancouver, BC. That's his goal. It's Seattle's goals. It's state of Oregon's goal.
And it's to reduce it below the levels at 1990, right?
Correct.
So 1990 has been used as the baseline, which was probably not a very good year, but a lot better than 2000.
And I'm over my head here in terms of why 1990 was selected, in part because of Kyoto, I think, and it's sort of become a global baseline. But in why exactly I don't know. I don't know. How's that?
Why not 1950?
I have no idea. I do know that, you know, 1990, it's in part what I've heard is that, you know, our life wasn't that much different than it is today. And so it's a year that's still within people's distant memory, and they know that it, you know, life at that time wasn't like so radically, you know, inferior to what we have now, that it You know.
But that was a year of property tax limitations in Portland. So.
Oh, that was painful, let me tell you.
So, but and then the other years that have been thrown out, I know that 2050 seems like, for some people, that's really far off. And why are we waiting so long? And there has been pushed, like, well, 2012 is another year that I've heard is for is one of the baselines. And then some people would have liked to see drastic reductions by 2020.
Sure.
Why? It, would it be possible to have 80% reduction in by 2020, or is that just like there's no way we could do it?
I don't want to say that it's impossible. What I'm very careful to do is to put out there, you know, audacious goals that are doable. If you've seen over the last 10 years, you had a lot of politicians throw out, you know, we're going to plant a million trees, you know, and then they don't. You know, we're going to meet these audacious goals, and then they don't. So, you know, I'm trying to stay with the best Portland spirit in terms of really difficult but doable goals. And 2050 is too far out there, and that's why we've got sort of 2030 objectives in terms of 40%. And when you look at the plan online, you'll see that we have, you know, 2012 actions as well to really ramp up and jumpstart our efforts to meet the interim goals. So audacious, doable, within a timeline that's realistic, but will take real effort.
Well, in the remaining moments, we got some more phone calls to take. I want to, before the end of the show, sort of look at some of the things that we can all do as individuals. Is at the same time that I'm one of those people that do not like to say, well, individuals can make a big change and we'll forget about government and industry, because it's obviously a partnership. But I think it's important that we as individuals also kind of look at the specific things that we can do that might feed into government and industry as well. But we do have some callers waiting to talk. And we got Dan on the line. Good morning. You're on the air.
Good morning, Barbara and Mayor Adams.
Good morning.
You mentioned that financing is a critical issue. In the Lentz Urban Renewal Area, they're going to take $42 million and log Lentz Park. These 100-year-old trees are going to be torn down for parking lots and a baseball stadium. There, I guess over 100 trees are going to be torn down. Instead of using $42.3 million to subsidize a multimillionaire to buy, to build his baseball park in a public park, why don't we use that to develop green jobs?
Well, I wouldn't support any plan that logged 100 trees off of Lentz Park. Let's just get that really clear. And I know that those kinds of numbers have been bandied about. The second thing is we haven't come to an agreement yet with Mr. Paulson. You know, baseball stadiums, you know, they have to largely pay for themselves over time. It's about creating amenity in the city that's, you know, family friendly. You know, same kinds of arguments to me are made around arts and culture as they are around sports. I don't, you know, look at them as big money makers. I look at them as, you know, family friendly amenities within the city. And for a lot of people, this is, you know, something that they're passionate about. So we're looking at Lentz Park. We wouldn't even be looking at Lentz Park. I wouldn't have even looked at the Rose Garden before that if it hadn't already been considered and discussed in their previous neighborhood plan. So in 1996, you know, the neighborhood plan in Lentz was to expand Walker Field to a 10,000-seat stadium. We went through a citywide stadium review and identified the Rose Quarter. Fundamentally, it's going to be up to Lentz. You know, I've made it very clear. We'll put together the best possible public-private deal. In this case, you know, Merritt Paulson has to put up tens of millions of dollars in order for this to go forward. But in the end, you know, I'm going to look to the Urban Renewal Advisory Committee whether they want to go forward with it or not. And if they choose not to, I won't support it.
I'm going to say this is another subject we're going to be taking up. We will be talking a lot more about baseball and Lentz. And so I think that I don't want to get too sidetracked on that today. But thanks a whole lot for calling.
Have a good day.
Sure. And I'm not sure if we have any other callers lined up at the moment. We got Maria on the line. If you want to, well, Maria's gone. Anyway, if you want to join the conversation, we're talking this morning with Mayor Sam Adams, and we're talking about Portland's climate change plan, and this is a good opportunity. If you have read it already, it is online at Portland Online. Let me see this again. I need to get this out. Okay. It's on portlandonline.com/BPS/climate, or you can just Google Portland Climate Change Climate Action Plan 2009. But it is, I think, something, a very important document to read, and it's not actually that that wonky to read.
You're very kind to say
it's parts of it are pretty wonky, I'll have to say. But I read it
pretty... There's nothing wrong with being wonky.
It's got lots of pretty pictures and...
lots of pretty pictures.
And nice layout. And actually, I read it pretty quickly. And it's, I think, both very inspiring to see how far Portland has come in professing an ethic that we used to think was kind of like the hippie green ethic, but now seems to be...
The hippies have won.
That's right, and they've taken over City Hall.
That's right.
It just says people make fun... I mean, George Bush was right. This is little Beirut here. But anyway, but I think that it's a very... It's a rather powerful statement to look at as far as the vision that Portland's trying to put forward, and then also it needs a lot more specifics. That's my sense about it, that the generalities are great, but how it's actually going to be enacted and some of the very specific action items are things where you can have input and you can follow your comments. So it's, for those of you who have already read the plan, this is a good opportunity to talk with the mayor and give him your opinions. And you can call at 503-231-8187. It's about 60 minutes before 9 o'clock here on Locus Focus. We have Jeff on the line. Good morning. You're on the air.
Morning, Barb. Thanks for taking my call. Morning, Mr. Mayor.
Good morning, Jeff.
I wanted to say that 1990, a good reason it seems to me why the 1990 number were chosen is it's probably almost obvious that 1990 was a cleaner, if you will, year, certainly in America after the EPA and so forth, than 1970. So I'm rather glad that the 1990 numbers have been chosen rather than some of those earlier, which we were even dirtier than the 1990.
Good point.
Question. The fact is you're talking about the energy sources, where they come from, where we get our resources, and how green we can be on that end. The other end seems so critically important, not just our solid waste, and already I recycle nearly everything. Everything is packaged. The whole package goes into the recycling bins one by one by one. But solid waste that is not recyclable, and sewerage, and most especially a conundrum that's facing so many cities, is the in-sewer outfall,
right,
is contained the frightening quantities of prescription medications, apparently birth control medicine amongst the many of them, which changes the hormones of the fish and so forth. And that seems a big problem. I don't know if that goes right to carbon. I know that solid waste disposal does go to carbon, not just by people picking it up and taking it to the landfill, but by every step of the way that these solid waste become that, it is a reduction of that part of the plan. And the second question is, Mr. Mayor, if the Attorney General comes back with a bad report that shows a crime was committed, are you prepared to step down? I'll take the answer.
Actually, we're not going to deal with that. This is not related to the show today. So we're going to only answer the first question.
So this particular plan is focused on carbon reduction. And it links up and is intended to complement and strengthen our other plans on greater green, our green streets strategy as well. So there are linkages between other plans. This is focused on greenhouse gas reductions. The issues that you've raised are very serious issues that we are going to have to grapple with. The toxicity of our sewer outfalls is a real concern. It's not all the science has been done to figure out how to remove some of those poisons, but I think it is a sort of misnomer by a lot of people that, you know, the pipe at the end of our sewer system is somehow clean water. It's cleaner water than the input to the sewer system, and it meets federal regulations in part because the pipe goes out to the middle of the Columbia River, and the Columbia River is so big that the sewer output is diluted. The CSO program, we are on time, we are on budget. By 2011, the outfalls into the Willamette River will largely end. We've paid $1.4 billion for that. And it was mandated by the federal government in 1995, And it's a project that is sort of reflects the old gray engineering, gray as in gray pipe sort of engineering approach. Over the years, we've tried to get the federal government to allow us to green it up. It's been a struggle. Largely, they've said no, but we've done sort of extra credit anyway. And the Greater Green Program, the Green Streets Program, and others have been our efforts in that area. But the issue as it relates back to and what Mike Houck was talking about in this plan is the resilience of our existing sort of systems in the sewer systems with 37 inches of rainfall a year. Maybe it'll be more or less now or come at different times. That's the adaptation that you, Barbara, were talking about and Mike was talking about that, you know, we need to do more work on. And by the fall after the emergency Portland Office of Emergency Management evaluation, we'll need to strengthen this that portion of this plan.
Okay, and thanks for the caller. I actually wanted to talk a bit about the food and agriculture aspect of this plan, because this is something that I also found pretty exciting. One of the tones of it is basically we're going to encourage everybody in Portland to eat less meat, eat less red meat. Actually, it sounded like chicken and fish are probably okay, but red meat, too much carbon consumption. And then the other part, which I think a lot of local voers would be very ecstatic about, is really the emphasis on not just eating locally produced food, but the emphasis on community gardens, encouraging people to do backyard gardens and urban farms, and then the tie-in between that and protecting farmland around the city. And I this is when I start feeling like an old codger, when I was, I remember back when I came to Portland and it was surrounded by farms, and I remember when Meadowland Dairy was a dairy and not a housing development and a Bi-Mart and a very nice nature park. But, you know, you start feeling like an old codger doing that. But I feel very privileged that I can remember back, it was only 35 years ago, that Portland was surrounded by farms. And yet, there are, what's exciting now is that there still are farms in the outskirts of Portland, unlike any other city I can think of that's our size. So this plan really emphasizes protecting what still remains of farmland around Portland, and it sounds like really encouraging there to be more.
Yeah, and you know, we lay out sort of the facts around, you know, carnivore consumption versus vegetarian consumption, and we let people make, you know, their own judgments. We just lay out the facts on that. What we do promote is the local, to buy local, grow local. Passionate gardener myself. I don't want to get into a big debate over, you know, with the cattle industry and the chicken industry, you know, I don't want to get in that big debate, have this plan be sort of the crosshairs of that big debate. So we just present the facts, get people informed. But what we are prioritizing in this plan is local, buy local. That's a good sort of initial approach to reducing the greenhouse gas impacts of food. And most people have no idea the massive negative impacts of how we, the choices we make around food consumption.
So how would this plan really, and again, these probably aren't fleshed out specifically, but what would be your thoughts about how this plan could really reinforce and strengthen the local food production, which, I mean, we are actually at the crosshairs of losing. Like, I remember a few years ago, there was a strawberry crisis because a lot of the strawberry farmers in the Willamette Valley just threw in the towel because the California growers were able to grow these strawberries that shipped so well everywhere. Of course, they don't taste like anything, but that didn't seem to matter anymore. So they were growing grass seed in this incredible strawberry farm.
Exactly.
Company. And what's, I think, come and save the strawberries of Oregon in the farmers markets, which is now where you go to buy really good strawberries. And there's a resurgence of appreciation about what makes Oregon strawberries special and why they only last for a day. And that's why they're so good. But how do we encourage other parts of, I mean, the other place which has really fallen away is local small poultry farms in Oregon. It's very hard to really find any poultry that's raised in Oregon for a variety of reasons.
Well, on food and agriculture production, I'm more radical than the draft plan in the sense that I think we need to have zones that aren't just for agriculture, but as a zoning designation for food-producing agricultural land. And I think that we need to set as a goal for ourselves the notion of a percentage of self-sufficiency for food within a certain radius of the city. So, you know, that's a pretty radical change in the way that we do things. I think that you know, that's the way we need to go. More work needs to be done on that and sort of to figure out how to indeed test whether that is really is a good idea and how to implement. In the meantime, the urban growth boundary expansion discussion where some proponents have put on the table, you know, a 50% expansion in the urban growth boundary through establishing rural reserves, which is like getting an increase in your maximum amount you can put on a credit card. I mean, it just foretells what the future expansions will be. I passionately oppose that. We should be investing in, you know, what we already have, which we're way behind on in terms of just basic maintenance of the current infrastructure. We will never have the money to adequately connect these outlier areas with the other infrastructure. But I also want to look at, and we will look at, the best practices around larger scale food production within the city as well. There are great programs out there that, you know, we're going to be looking at in Chicago, based in Chicago and other places, where they take small pieces of unlikely land, but you have a lot of it, working with nonprofits and for-profits, and begin food production on that land. I mean, in some cases, you know, we've shown that, you know, with the City Hall garden, that a tiny little plot is producing a lot of food in a very unlikely place.
Actually, I've met farmers who sell at some of the farmers markets. There's one man who lives around Hillsborough, I think, and he basically sells on the West Side markets. And he has a bunch of little plots. I think the biggest plot he has is like 1.5 acres, but he's got a lot of them. And they're all around, and they're like on the edges of Hillsborough, which is an interesting place, which I remember when that was a farming town. But it is. What I really love about Hillsborough is, even though it's become this little high-tech mecca, urban mecca there, mm-hmm. that right on the outskirts, walking distance from downtown Hillsborough, are farms.
Right.
And there is a way that Hillsborough has figured out how to sustain its farming traditions while it's also building up its high-tech future.
And we've got, you know, all this acreage in the city of Portland with these flat rooftops, you know, much less the angled rooftops. In terms of our version of eco-roofs, I hope a big percentage of our eco-roofs will be food-producing eco-roofs, you know. So, you know, as we're looking, for example, you know, we're looking for to figure out what to do with Memorial Coliseum and figure out something that's economically sustainable. And so I was looking around the building, it's like good acreage on the top of Memorial Coliseum that should be food producing. As we're looking at other retrofits, you know, what can we do to make sure that they're eco roofs, but they're also helping to contribute to our food security?
Yeah, I guess when they're not eco roofs, they could have solar panels like the rooftops of all the buildings in the Googleplex.
You can do both. Yeah. You can do both.
Now, we're kind of running out of time. I don't know if we have any more callers. We're going to try to squeeze 3 callers in really quickly.
Lightning round.
That's right. So this is, and you can ask the mayor now about climate change action here in Portland. We got Matt on the line. Good morning. You're on the air.
Hello. Just wondering if you could make a comment on what the plan does for low-income senior citizens and people that might be living on Social Security or disability payments.
Okay. Thanks a lot for calling.
The Clean Energy Fund is aimed at folks that rent, as much as it is aimed at folks that are own or buying. And we also, as part of that, have a job aspect, so that we're putting people to work. We're creating a new industry, and we're putting people to work, workforce training, not just for my hope is that as we do the Clean Energy Fund retrofits, we're also have people working at those jobs, but also have a skill and educational component as well.
Great. And we're going to squeeze in 2 more callers. We got Mitch on the line. Good morning. You're on the air.
Hi, this is Mitch in NOPO. You sound great, Mayor Adams.
Thank you, Mitch.
How about a lot fewer street lights and the ones that we have radically more efficient?
On the to-do list, you've really touched on, you know, we are a major consumer of electricity to light the streets, and LED is provides better light than we have right now at a operation at a much cheaper price. We're in active negotiations with some of those producers. The cost per bulb is very high, but we're an active sort of, a lot of people want to be, to introduce their products here in Portland, so we're seeing what we can do in terms of working out, sort of being a test place for them. We're also looking at federal stimulus funding as a way to retrofit, but we're a huge consumer of electricity, again, 42% of which comes from coal with our streetlights, so you've hit on a really good point.
Great, and we got time for one more caller. I've got Alan on the line. Good morning. You're on the air.
Yeah, yes, Mayor. I have a proposal for the bridge across the Columbia in such a way that it could provide a significant amount of power back into the system.
Great.
And that is, I'd heard that there was a proposal to provide power for the lighting on the bridge using windmill around the edge of the bridge. And I think that a better idea would be to drop sort of a stern wheel or a paddle wheel design down into the river itself in such a way that it would not affect fish passage, but would connect to a turbine and be on floating pontoons. And basically each span of the bridge, it could be buttressed with concrete buttresses, like, you know, a Gothic cathedral. Underneath each span section going across the river would be a significantly large paddle wheel on a set of pontoons, and it would raise and lower along with the river level, and each one would be connected to turbines, and this would provide power back into light rail or lighting for the bridge.
I actually have to cut you off because we're just about out of time. It sounds like a really great idea.
It's a great idea. We've actually been looking at it for the Willamette River bridges as well. So it's on the list. It's a great idea. It's used in other communities.
And so in the last minute that we have here, Mayor Adams, could you talk about the town halls that are coming up and how people can get involved in this plan?
Yeah, again, Portland Online, it's on the front page of Portland Online. It's also on the front page of MayorSamAdams.com. But we've got town halls in southeast, southwest, north, the downtown, central city area, and northeast. Encourage people to turn out. This is very much a two-way conversation, just like this great radio program. This is the Climate Action Plan that is the public comment draft, and it's only going to get better with your input, your questions, your comments.
Well, thanks a whole lot for joining us. This has been a really good conversation, and I'm
Thank
very
you,
happy
Barbara.
To live in a city like this. This is our future plan.
Thank you.
And we're going to go out with some music by Joni Mitchell, and next week we're going to be talking about Sunday Parkways, kind of a microcosm of what we're talking about today. Thanks for listening.